Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. It's the weekly show about health, nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle in general. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, first this morning, we'll talk about a very fitting topic given the snowfall yesterday. We'll be speaking with Paul Daigle. He's the director of the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center. Always interesting. Paul joins us to talk about snow science, scary avalanches, and other kinds of avalanche related things.
Like birthdays?
Oh, like yes, like birthdays.
Whose birthday was it yesterday?
It was my birthday yesterday, and that's why that snow came.
Yeah, that's right.
That's why there's an avalanche warning today.
What about the other birthday girls?
I don't know if they want me to talk about that. Don't need to put us on the spot here on air. Who's okay. Next?
Then New York Times bestselling author Simon Garfield, letter writer extraordinaire, who will talk about a lost art and his new book, To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing.
And finally, an interesting guy. He was a former speech writer for Al Gore, an author of many New York Times bestsellers. It's Daniel Pink. He's the author of the book, To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. That book is now in paperback. It came out earlier this year. But an interesting conversation with him. Stay with us. This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
I'm John Wells.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Join us for Cool Science Radio Thursdays at 9 a.m.
From the discovery of new dinosaurs to the science of an avalanche.
From the secret technology behind Facebook to nanotechnology.
Deciphering science and tech in an entertaining, amusing, and accessible way.
It's Cool Science Radio. If we understand it, so can you.
Thursdays at 9 a.m. only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Brought to you by Peak Art and Frame.
KPCW's new classified ads are now on Facebook. Join the Facebook group KPCW Classifieds and Rideboard and see what's being sold, hired, rented, and searched for today. Post what you're getting rid of or what you're looking for free. Another service for locals, only in Park City, only on KPCW.
Hi, I'm Kelly from San Francisco Design, longtime supporter of KPCW. We provide a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings for a unique Park City lifestyle. Our showrooms are in Park City and Salt Lake, and both offer complete design services. We're on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with Tim Henney. Well, when snow falls like it did yesterday and hopefully will continue to do throughout all week, avalanche danger is real. And along with the snow, unfortunately, comes the abandonment from time to time of both reason and caution. But that's why the Utah Avalanche Center is here and reaching far into the Wasatch Mountains, along with education, avalanche advisories, and all other kinds of warnings and information for both the serious backcountry enthusiast and also the tourist who may just come to town and want to go for a simple snowshoe up Daly Canyon. So joining us now to talk about all things snow and avalanche related is Paul Daigle. He's the director of the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center. And good morning to you, Paul.
Good morning, Lynn. What a beautiful morning, too, to be talking about this. I was afraid we were going to be talking about hiking and mountain biking today.
I know.
It did look that way.
I feel only a little bit guilty that I've got you in here, sitting here talking about avalanches rather than out there skiing, but it's a good sacrifice.
It's a tough one on a sunny powder day.
I know, that's right. So, let me start with something I said in that intro there. I mean, we all remember, those of us who were here about 10 years ago, I think it was, there was a tourist in town and they just went walking up Daly Canyon here, snowshoeing, and had no idea about degree of slope and avalanche danger. And it was after a huge dump. And I don't know if you remember this because it happened up here, but an avalanche came down, buried one of them, and he ended up losing his life. There was a lot surrounding that incident. It had to do with, you know, rescue and how we go about that in this area, and And, you know, I just wanted you to maybe comment first on that, is what we don't know that we don't know.
Well, yeah, that was a tragic accident. And I think that really was an example of how we may think of avalanches as something that happens in faraway places and to extreme athletes and to people that are living on the edge. And it's easy to forget that we live in an area very, very close to avalanches. I mean, look around, look outside your window, and you can see avalanche terrain from here. So it's something that we all need to be aware of. And it just points out that if you're going to be out skiing, snowshoeing, snowmobiling, snowboarding, walking your dog, you need to have some sense of avalanche issues.
Paul, are there more people these days exposing themselves to the potential of avalanche? More people getting into the backcountry by various means?
You know, it looks to us like every year the number of people out in the backcountry and exposed to avalanche danger just about doubles. We see it in movies. We see it on YouTube. We get good equipment. We hear of our friends going out in the backcountry. There's more and more competition for untracked powder. There's lots of good reasons for people to go out in the backcountry. And yes, absolutely, we're seeing that.
We've heard that it's the sector of the market in terms of winter sport that is growing, that's not flat. I mean, many sectors of the market are flat, but the backcountry market is actually growing. And I'm wondering what your thought on that is.
Well, we're hearing the same thing. We are hearing from people in the ski industry that are very interested in backcountry because backcountry gear and side country gear is really the only growth piece of the snow sports industry market right now. So more and more people are getting the gear. They're interested in going out. At the same time, skier days on the lifts are flat. So yeah, there's this growing interest. There's a lot of new people that really don't have a backcountry mountain culture. They just haven't been trained to think about avalanches. They're used to skiing steep runs at resorts and doing just fine.
Is there a greater inherent risk with backcountry versus other forms of recreating in the mountains? And is there a way to mitigate that to kind of equalize, or is there always going to be a greater inherent risk?
Yes, there is a greater risk in the backcountry. And the reason is that every morning before daylight, Ski Patrol is out controlling the ski runs. And so we get used to skiing steep runs and snowboarding steep runs that would be avalanche terrain. They are avalanche terrain before the resort opens, but every day these men and women are out there making it safe for us. So it's a little bit like going to the zoo. When you go to the zoo and you walk around, if you're on one side of the fence looking at the grizzly bears, it's quite safe. But when you step over the fence, suddenly the game changes a lot and you'd better hang on to your popcorn because you're now in a different environment. Nobody's watching out for you. So we can't completely eliminate the danger. What we need to do is learn to change the way we behave in avalanche terrain. The danger is still there. We can choose whether we're exposed to it or not.
And what are the greatest things people can do to change their behavior when they step outside the fence?
You know, there's a handful of really simple things we can do. First of all, check the avalanche forecast every day. If you hear that the avalanche danger is considerable or high or extreme, you know that it's going to be dangerous out there. And if you don't have good skills, that's a good day to stay within the resort boundaries, to go skating, to go do something else. When you do go out, there's simple things you can do to keep yourself safe, like only exposing one person in a group at a time. You don't gang ski something. You do it one at a time. So somebody is available to do a rescue if you need to. You watch for signs of avalanches. And the best sign of avalanche danger is other avalanches. When you hear cracking and collapsing and the snow sounds hollow and you look across the valley and you see other avalanches, that's a good sign you're getting into hazardous terrain. And you watch your slope angles very carefully. Avalanches occur on a pretty small range of slope angles.
What are those slope angles? Above 30?
Well, it's between about 30 and 40 degrees, maybe 30 and 42 or 43 degrees. And that's a pretty small range. So it sounds like it would be pretty easy to avoid. The problem is that's a really common slope angle, and it's really fun to ski and ride on. That's what we get used to riding expert runs at resorts.
Right. So I'm one of those backcountry skiers that knows enough to always stay on the mellowest of slopes. And then I do probably a lot of people are guilty of this. I give other people credit for knowing more than I do, which, you know, I think you should probably never do. But one of the things that amazes me is that the few people that I find that go out, even if we're planning on going on a very mellow slope, with a, what's it called that measures the incline?
Inclinometer.
Inclinometer.
Actually, I call it an iPhone app.
Oh. Oh, yeah, there we go. Ah, so that is so simple. But even for someone like myself who says, okay, I love to backcountry ski, I love the exercise, but I have no need to ever go on a slope above 30 degrees in pitch. That's not necessarily a surefire way to never get caught in a slide, right?
Absolutely. The snowshoer or the hiker you were talking about was not on a steep slope. He was in a what we call a terrain trap. He was in a gully at the bottom of a steep slope. So a relatively small avalanche can come down into one of these gullies and pile up really deep. That's a common problem for snowshoers because, especially on a stormy day, a gully is a nice place to hang out. It's sheltered. It's out of the wind. It's a good place to talk and have lunch. But when you look up and see an avalanche slope above you, you are still at risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very good point. And you may not, without a lot of experience, you can't look at that slope and say, oh, that looks like potential for danger. That looks like potentially over 30 degrees.
Right. It's hard to tell from the bottom looking up without some experience. It's something you learn. It's like driving a car. When you first go out, everything's new and it's terrifying. And after a while, it becomes fairly second nature.
Paul, what about even the approach, skiers skinning, snowshoers hiking, and they're doing the switchback and they're crossing over terrain. They obviously shouldn't bunch together because, as you were saying, if something happens, you want to have enough of a spread between your party so that somebody's available for a rescue if that's necessary, or you only catch one person at a time. Is that another component of this, is the approach aspect, as well as the skiing or the coming down through these terrain?
You know, I think the approach is maybe the most important aspect, the most important thing to think about when you're out in avalanche terrain for a couple of reasons. First is you spend a lot of time on the uphill. You know, if you look at how much time of the day you spend going down versus going up, you're slow going up and you're exposed for a long time. Second, that's a really good way to observe what's going on, and that's how we stay safe in avalanche terrain, is by being very observant. We aren't concerned about crashing. We aren't concerned about what's around the next corner. We have time to look around. We look for other avalanches. Again, we listen to sounds the snow is making. If we hear that whoomp, and then mm-hmm. you hear it sort of echoing across the slope, that's a bad sign. If you're not paying attention, if you're listening to music, you might miss that. It's a good time to talk to your partners about where are we going to ski, what are the conditions today, how good do we feel about this. There's a lot that goes on the uphill.
Now, Paul, let's talk a little bit about the organization. You've explained this to me before, where the forecasters that we hear from every morning, that's Drew Hardesty and Bruce Tremper and Evelyn and who else am I missing? Great folk who call into KPCW every
Brett
morning.
Brett Kobernick, Craig Gordon.
Okay.
We have seven forecasters around the state.
Okay, and they are employed by the U.S. Forest Service.
That's correct.
But you are sort of the fundraising and supportive arm of the Utah Avalanche Center. Talk a little
right.
bit about how that goes, those distinctions.
Well, this is a really interesting collaborative effort. It's a pretty unique model. The Utah Avalanche Center is actually a collaborative effort between the Forest Service, Utah Avalanche Center, and the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center, a nonprofit group. And so we raise about two-thirds of the money to run the organization through the nonprofit channels, through donations, events like the Powder Horror movie coming up Thursday night at the Santee, grants by teaching avalanche classes, things like that. The other third comes from the Forest Service, State of Utah, and Salt Lake County. We at the Friends also manage the education and awareness program. So whenever you go to a lecture, when you take a class, that's part of the nonprofit effort. And we work obviously very close together.
Okay. And I was so happy to hear this the other day. I know you try to hit, your goal is to hit every school kid in Utah, basically, right? With this Know Before You Go kind of campaign. Mm-hmm. I was going to go for an afternoon hike up Deer Valley. And my son, who's at Park City High School, he texted and said, you know, we just had that avalanche awareness seminar, and I don't think you should go. And I was like, that is awesome.
Now, when is the last time your teenager told you to be safe?
I know. So talk about that program.
Well, that's a really exciting program that's been in place now for 9 years. What we did is we put together a 50-minute presentation, so it fits in a school program, that's all about avalanche awareness. And this was a radical change in the avalanche world. We don't teach people avalanche science in this program. We don't teach them about snow crystals. We show them loud music. We show them footage of avalanches. We talk to avalanche survivors and victims and rescuers. And it's all about making people aware of avalanche issues and aware that they're getting into avalanche terrain and how destructive avalanches can be. And it shows them how to get more education and how to become more avalanche aware.
Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic program.
Paul, you mentioned apps in kind of joking. Are there apps that actually help people in the backcountry today?
Absolutely. I wasn't joking a bit. Most people that I see now, instead of carrying inclinometers, they just use free apps on their smartphones to measure slope angle. The Utah Avalanche Center has an app that basically consolidates our website, puts all the information you need for immediate decision making in one place with some navigation tools. So if you go to our website and search for the iPhone app, unfortunately not a Droid app yet, you can see that. If you search around, there are a handful of other apps as well to help you pick terrain, help you get avalanche forecasts around the United States. There's an app for everything now.
And how about current conditions? What has happened with this snowfall? Have we had a good setup with bonding and temperatures and layering of the snow, or are we in a bad position right now?
Well, I wouldn't call this a perfect storm, but I'd call it a pretty darn good storm.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. Good in the sense of being dangerous.
Okay. Well, yeah. So what happened? Why don't you walk us through what happened with this snowfall?
Well, what we really don't like to see in the fall is to get an early snowfall and then a couple of weeks of cold, dry weather, which is what we've had the last few weeks. What happens is the snow on the ground decomposes. It sits and rots, and it becomes this kind of loose, sugary snow. And then along comes a storm like we had last night and yesterday, and we dump a big pile of bricks on top of this loose pile of junky snow. And so we get avalanches. There were a lot of avalanches yesterday. I think at the moment there probably isn't enough snow for big destructive avalanches, but from what we saw yesterday, there were lots and lots of avalanches, and some of them were big enough to potentially carry and hurt a person. So it's going to take a while for this to heal. When people go out now, they're going to have to be on their best behavior for a while. We don't know. It's going to take a bit of snow and some time.
What is the healing process? Time and snow, how does that come into play, and what happens to heal this setup?
Well, that's when you start getting into the molecular issues of snow science. But basically what happens is you get more and more snow sitting on a weak layer, and it kind of squishes that weak layer. And it forms a sort of a protective shield over it, and it makes the underlying layers less important as you get deeper and deeper.
Okay. Paul Daigle is the executive director of the Friends of the Utah Avalanche Center. Anything else you wanted to say? Maybe you should give us the information about the Powder Whore movie coming up this week.
Well, we're going to be at the Santee on Thursday night at 7:30, I think. It's going to be a fundraising movie. It is the final stop in the Powder Whore World Tour of their backcountry ski movie. It's always a fun event. We're going to be doing a raffle to benefit the Utah Avalanche Center. It should be a lot of fun. So I encourage everybody to come out. I also encourage everybody to go to our website, www.utahavalanchecenter.org, and look at the events calendar. You can see free awareness talks in the Park City area. There you can get more details on upcoming fundraising events, upcoming classes. Everything going on avalanche related is on that site.
And they can sign up for a daily email.
They can. We're in the process of switching over our email system at the moment, and it could be a week or so before that's completely sorted out. So if you sign up now, you might not see anything for a little while. But yes, you can get the daily advisory for the Central Wasatch emailed to you.
And I want to just mention, this is a great way if you don't know much about avalanches, just to go on the website, especially after there has been some avalanche activity. It's very educational. You guys do such a great job of updating, you know, immediately, right? Even from the field, they'll post photos and they'll show the layers of after a slide happens, and it's really very comprehensive.
Yes. I mean, we try to put everything that we can think of and everything we find on that site. We've got tutorial videos. We teach little lessons. We've got a glossary of terms. We've got tons of photos and videos. We love smartphones. We submit reports and observations and forecasts from tree wells in the middle of a storm, in the middle of the Wasatch. We have a Twitter feed, so you can get text messages updating you on avalanche conditions and changing snow conditions. There's so many different ways to get the information.
Right.
It all starts from our website.
Okay. Paul Daigle, thanks so much for your time today. Happy skiing and safe skiing. And this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Simon Garfield. He's going to talk to us about the lost, almost lost art, maybe the reviving art of letter writing.
The Glittertind at Stein Erickson Lodge is a proud supporter of KPCW. The Glittertind restaurant offers regional American cuisine with Chef Zane Holmquist's seasonal menus. Located mid-mountain at Deer Valley Resort, the Glittertind serves breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily. Sunday brunch with live music. Reservations recommended. 645-6455.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, when was the last time you sat down and wrote a letter? Our next guest celebrates the lost art of letter writing and explores what has become of just sitting down with pen and paper. It's Simon Garfield, and he talks about how from how the etiquette of the opening address to the sign-off and even that kiss. Remember when you used to put lipstick on, Tim, and kiss the back of the...
Yeah, I do remember that, Lynn.
And can anything be done to revive a practice that has dictated and tracked the progress, really, of our civilization for more than 500 years? And Simon Garfield, the author of To the Letter, is now joining us on the phone. And welcome to you, Simon Garfield. Simon, do we have you there?
Okay, great. Well, it's very nice to be with you.
Well, Simon, I just wanted to ask you first, at first glance, your book is about the lost art of letter writing, which makes me think, you know, we're mourning and grieving the loss of this dwindling art. But it's not so much that as it is capturing really the history and all these wonderful stories about the art of letter writing, maybe before it does go away.
Well, yes, I was sort of keen not just to kind of, you know, mourn a passing art, but as you say, to celebrate, you know, what we have and what we've had in the past, and also to really explain, you know, quite how big this loss may be. I mean, in a way, we're going through a kind of golden age of letter writing, books at least at the moment, insofar as there are some fantastic collections that have come out recently, letters of Hemingway and Paul Cézanne, and, you know, I could go on. But I wonder, and my fear really, I think, is are we going to get these kind of great collections in 100 years' time or so? And I think not. And I think it'll be very sad if we just have, you know, collections of short emails. And I also begin to wonder at the end of the book whether emails aren't even a passing phase, whether or not we'll all just end up communicating by texts and tweets.
It's true. And in that, of course, we can imagine what it is that we lose. You know, we lose some element of creativity and putting lots of words to express a feeling in totality, really.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we you know, people say, oh, well, you know, we have emails, so, you know, what's the big deal? But actually, the way we write emails, we don't express the same sort of depth or the same sort of emotions as we do. And also, you know, they tend to be very instant. And letters tend to be more thoughtful, and they amass a certain amount of information, and they're kind of brought together with a beginning and a middle and an end. And also we have, you know, huge problems, I think, not only kind of for our kids and grandchildren as well, you know, who will probably find it quite hard to find out how we lived our lives. I don't think they're going to sort of discover any emails in the attic. But also a great problem for historians, really. You know, how are we going to tell how we really lived and what we really thought about our times without letters?
Simon, I have a 25-year-old daughter and a 23-year-old son, and it's interesting because my son, when he was 14, I took him to the post office. It was his first attempt at using the mail and writing a letter. He didn't know how the mail system worked. He didn't understand why a stamp went on an envelope. And then my daughter writes continuously by snail mail, is what we call it. So traditional letters to my mother. They are pen pals, and they exchange written letters continuously. So I have these two children of the same generation from the same family, one that has no knowledge of letter writing at all, and one who practices it daily.
Well, that's great. I'm obviously with your daughter on that one. I mean, my kids, I think, are pretty much a similar age, and they do know just about how to write a letter, but their attitude is, well, you know, why should I? You know, it's sort of, well, you know, postage is expensive, and you know, you mean I've got to sit down at a desk with a pen and get an envelope and then catch the last post, and you know, but meanwhile they've got everything open, they're communicating as much as we ever did, but it's a shorter form, and it's all, you know, they've got their sort of social messaging open and their Facebook page and, you know, all of that. So they are writing, but they're writing in a far less kind of formal way, which you think is a good thing. But the question is what we leave sort of behind, and I think that's a shame. I would be fairly horrified if I felt that, you know, all I was going to leave behind was just a sort of trail of kind of tweets, which were, you know, just fun comments on news or things which wouldn't even make sense because they were like part of a conversation rather than a kind of whole letter. And so I think that's the thing. But it's very, very obvious in a way that we don't write letters in the way that we used to, you know. And you kind of think, okay, well, that's great. It's technological progress. And, you know, we're a sort of a kind of race that likes to seize new opportunities, and isn't that great? But it's a huge, huge loss, I think, that we're going to face, and it's come upon us sort of in a very gradual way. And so, the attempt of the book was to, you know, was to say, are we prepared to actually kind of, you know, accept this loss?
So, Simon, the book, as you just said, is an attempt to memorialize what we potentially lose as we transition or transform our society away from letter writing to something else. But, and I know this wasn't the theme and the focus of the book, but while you were writing the book, did anything come to you about what we as a society might gain from transforming away from traditional letter writing to these new digital formats?
Yeah, I mean, I do wonder about that. And towards the end of the book, I talked to some archivists at leading institutions, including the fantastic Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas, which has a wonderful collection of kind of writers, manuscripts, and letters. And they have mixed views. In a way, what happens is that, you know, if emails survive, and that's a big question, then they tend to survive in very clear forms, and they, you know, and there are lots of duplicates. And, you know, if one knows passwords, if one can get to the cloud and all of that, you kind of think actually they're far more secure than letters ever were. Letters can get you know, lost in a flood or burnt or just disappear or, you know, kind of any of those things. So while I'm sense, you know, we make more copies. But I think overall the thinking is, and this is said, this is not just my view, but you know, sort of many historians and archivists as well. The general feeling is that it's not really the method of communication that is the real problem, but it's the fact that we don't and we're not writing in that kind of longer form, and we're not sort of using those very, very small details that we would do if we were, you know, writing a letter on a weekly basis, or, you know, even like, you know, as we used to do, you know, before the phone on, you know, we used to write three or four times, maybe to the same person even every day. And that's an extraordinary thing that we used to have, you know, letters that were delivered three or four. Now it seems impossible to imagine three or four times a day. And it's that really that I think, in particular, as I said, you know, historians fear that it's going to be very hard to patch together what a person really thought and really how they lived their lives from purely some kind of electronic media.
Simon, as you're talking, it's making me go to that place that I used to go when I would sit down and write a letter. And it makes me realize I haven't been there in a long time. So
I think the other point as well is that, you know, one gets a thrill. I get a thrill when I write letters and put them in a box. And when I receive them, you kind of think, generally, this is going to be interesting, you know, because hopefully it's kind of handwritten. You think, great, you know, it's something through the post that isn't a bill. You know, so that delight. I don't know about you, but I tend to groan when I see my inbox, you know, or my emails, because you kind of think, okay, you know, here we go. And the demand, the expectation is for an instant response as well. And that's another thing that I kind of think is something, you know, that kind of demand, I think, kind of weighs us down rather than fills us with joy in the way that letters used to do.
Simon, we've just got about 30 seconds left. Can you talk about maybe some of your favorite writers and, you know, authors and playwrights that you go back and talk about in the book?
Sure. Well, the book goes all the way back to kind of ancient Greece and ancient Rome. But I think there are two, and they're both poets who I really love. One is John Keats, and they're both English poets. One is John Keats. I live very near where Keats used to live, and he used to write beautiful letters. And the other is Ted Hughes, and the collection of Ted Hughes letters, not only to Sylvia Plath, but to his kids as well throughout his life, are just beautiful things. And as you would expect from both of those writers, they talk about their poetry, they experiment in sort of poetical forms in their letters, and they tell us a lot about their life and their work. So if I was to pick out any, I think it would be those two.
Very good. It's a beautiful book. Simon Garfield, thanks so much for your time today.
And I really enjoyed talking to you.
And that was Simon Garfield. He's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Just My Type and On the Map. This book, his new book, in fact, a nice one for the holiday season, To the Letter, a celebration of the lost art of letter writing. And you're listening to The Mountain Life. Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back with Daniel Pink.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is more than a fun look at the week's news. We also provide you with the latest developments in medicine and beer.
Bud does sound like the noise that people tend to make when they're having a heart attack.
Wait, Wait, the news quiz from NPR. It might just save your life.
Heard on KPCW Saturday morning at 9, thanks to 350 Main and the Spur Bar and Grill.
As the world evolves, so do our roles. At the Intermountain, Park City, Bonanza, and Round Valley Clinics, we have defined ours for you. I'm Dr. Lisa Saturnino, and excited to announce that the Bonanza Clinic is now a full-time InstaCare, exclusively for the urgent medical needs of our community. Our great partners at the Round Valley Clinic will now be the primary care experts. We are happy to provide expert care close to home. Intermountain Healthcare is a nonprofit organization.
Stand-up comedy returns to the Egyptian Theater this weekend, December 6th and 7th. Brighten the mood with some hearty laughter as comedians Shayla Rivera and Kirk Bogos make light of the everyday absurd. Stand-up at the Egyptian is always a hilarious night out and is recommended for mature audiences. Tickets start at only $19 and are available at parkcityshows.com or 649-9371. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with my co-host Tim Henney. Well, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, 1 in 9 Americans works in sales. But if you dig deeper, a startling truth emerges. So do the other 8. Whether we're employees pitching colleagues on a new idea, entrepreneurs enticing funders, or even parents and teachers cajoling children to study and go to bed. We spend our days trying to move others. Like it or not, we're all in sales now. Our next guest was a speechwriter for Al Gore, an aide to Robert Reich. And that was all before becoming quite gainfully employed as a writer. Daniel Pink is the author of 5 books, including the long-running New York Times bestsellers Drive and A Whole New Mind. And he's now joining us by phone to talk about his book that's just come out in paperback. It's called To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And Daniel Pink, welcome to you and good morning.
Okay.
Daniel Pink, I read, it was some line that jumped out at me in your book, and you use these adjectives about selling, and they were words like sweet and beautiful and urgent. And it just made me think that there's a whole new paradigm around selling.
That's exactly right. One of the things that's changed in selling is that when you ask people what's the first word that comes to mind, they think of far nastier words. They think of sleazy and dishonest and slimy. And I think that's an old-fashioned way to think about sales. Most of what we know about sales comes from a world of information asymmetry, where the seller always had more information than the buyer. When the seller has more information than the seller can rip you off.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the world we live in today. Whether you're selling anything, whether you're selling yourself for a job, whether you're selling your boss on doing things differently, whether you're asking somebody for a date, whether you're selling your car, buyers and sellers are much more evenly matched. And so in a world of information parity, which is the world that we live in now, you have to be much more honest, much more transparent, and ultimately much more human.
So, Daniel, I think that there are many people still going around with these words in their head like closing and
yeah.
Overcoming objections and all of that old style, you know, stereotype of the person who sells.
That's right. And so, you know, this old view of sales is actually pretty stubborn. But I think as people reflect on their own lives and they realize that they're spending an enormous amount of their own time selling, whether they are school teachers, whether they are entrepreneurs, whether they're in the medical professions, they're spending an enormous amount of their own time selling. And the way to do it effectively is to do it a little bit more humanely. And that's not because we've become better people. It's only because the information landscape has changed. So in the world where sellers have a lot more information than buyers, most of what we know about sales comes from that world. Sellers have a lot more information than buyers. Buyers don't have many choices, and buyers don't have a way to talk back. That's a world of buyer beware. But today, buyers have lots of information, lots of choices, and all kinds of ways to talk back. That's a world of seller beware. That's our world today, and seller beware is pushing more and more of us to the high road.
So, Daniel, in this world of information parity, who's your target audience for this book? I would think a book like this might have targeted how to sell and those who are selling in the past, but who's the new target audience?
For this book, I think it's anybody who is spending part of their time persuading or influencing others. So it's people who are in sales, people who are selling cars, insurance, consulting services. But I also think that it's teachers. Teachers are in the selling business. They're trying to persuade their students to pay attention, to do their homework. Parents, believe me, I'm a father of 3. Parents are in the persuasion and selling business. They're trying to persuade their kids to do things differently or do things in a different way. Bosses are in the selling business. You've got employees who you're trying to get, you know, like parents, trying to get things to do things differently or do things in a different way. And so, you know, one of the insights in the book is that, like it or not, we're all in sales now. We're spending an enormous amount of our time on the job, persuading, influencing, convincing other people, but in a way where the cash register is not ringing, money's not changing hands, and the denomination of the exchange isn't dollars, it's time, effort, attention, energy. And so we're spending a huge portion of our time in moving other people. The good news about all that is that we're doing it in a more even playing field. And the better news about that is that you can look to the social science to find some really compelling evidence-based ethical ways to do it more effectively.
Daniel, there's the term you used, information parity. I love that because it conveys just such an interesting thought. Another term that I ran across that you use that I really like and I'd like you to explain is ambivert.
Oh, yeah. Well, we tend to think that the most effective salespeople are extroverts. And what the research shows is that extroverts are more likely to go into sales. Extroverts are more likely to get hired in sales jobs. Extroverts are more likely to get promoted in sales jobs. The problem is that when scholars have looked at the link between extroversion and sales performance, not who gets hired or who promoted, but who sells stuff, the correlation is pretty much non-existent. And there's some new research out of the University of Pennsylvania with some very interesting and I think ultimately heartening findings. A guy named Adam Grant at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School did a study of a software company. He identified who the introverts were, who the extroverts were in the sales force. They went out and sold software, and here's what he found out. Strong introverts, terrible at sales. Strong introverts are terrible at sales. They don't assert. They're uncomfortable in social situations. But the bigger surprise is that strong extroverts, the people we think are the naturals, they weren't much better. And the reason is they talk too much and listen too little. They push too hard. They came on too strong. And what he found was that the people who were most effective in sales were the, as you said, the ambiverts. Ambiverts. Now, this is a term that a lot of us don't know, but it's actually been in the literature since the 1920s. And it describes people who are somewhat introverted and somewhat extroverted. They're in the middle. And these people end up being the best sellers because they're more attuned. They can go left. They can go right, like being ambidextrous. They know when to push. They know when to hold back. They know when to talk. They know when to listen. And the ambiverts have a clear advantage in selling. The good news there is that most of us are ambiverts. Relatively few of us are strong introverts. Relatively few of us are strong extroverts. Most of us are kind of in the middle, which suggests that most of us can be reasonably effective in selling.
And so, Daniel, that ambivert, one of the characteristics is the new ABC, is it not?
Sure. You know, the old ABCs is always be closing. You know, and that's actually an effective technique in a world where buyers have not much information, not many choices, and no way to talk back. But that's not our world. And so the new ABCs are the set of qualities that the social science tells us help us become effective in this world of information parity. And they are A, attunement, B, buoyancy, C, clarity. Attunement is perspective taking. Can you get out of your own head? See things from someone else's point of view. Buoyancy is how do you stay afloat on what one salesperson called the ocean of rejection that is sales. And then finally, clarity is how do you go from accessing information to curating information? How do you go from solving existing problems to identifying hidden problems? And so those ABCs are really the platform for effectiveness in this new terrain. And the social science, as I said, gives us some really, really specific, compelling tools about how to do it better.
Daniel, you know, it's interesting that you brought up Adam Grant. We spoke to him about his book, Give and Take, I believe it was called.
Sure.
And, you know, a lot of people we talk to on this show, whether we're talking business, whether we're talking personal life or mental health, there are these elements of vulnerability that you bring into your everyday practice, which we were surprised to find that, you know, you even bring a little self-doubt, a little vulnerability into the workplace, and you will emerge you'll climb the ladder faster and higher. And so this really ties into what you're talking about with selling and the ambivert concept. I'm wondering if you might comment on your speech writing time with Al Gore and applying these kind of principles to that. Would you comment on that?
Yeah, I think you make a real, I think it's a very, very good insight there about the importance of vulnerability, the importance of generosity, the importance of some of these things that we think superficially are kind of soft end up being a different form of power. I think that politicians in general often have kind of an old-fashioned notion of power that is very kind of chest-thumping, very assertive. And what some of the social science is telling us, both Adam Grant's work in his terrific book, Give and Take, Brené Brown's work on vulnerability, you know, some other kinds of social science is telling us that there's a quieter form of power that's more effective. But one of the things, again, looking at specific tools, is our self-talk. Human beings, all of us, we talk to ourselves. And there's a tendency to say, let's say you're going into an important sales call or an important encounter. The conventional view is that what we should do is we should pump ourselves up. It should be sort of loud and muscular. I can do this. You got this. You're awesome. And what the research shows is that that's actually better than doing nothing. It's better, that very kind of powerful, assertive self-talk is more effective than going in a purely neutral way. But it's not as effective as another alternative, which is what's called interrogative self-talk, which is not saying, you can do this, but actually asking a question. Can you do this? Now, as you say, asking yourself, can you do this, reveals a certain degree of vulnerability. But what's powerful about that approach is that questions, by their very nature, elicit an active response. So if I say to myself, can you do this, I got to answer. And I say, well, yeah, I can do this. I've pitched ideas or I've, you know, gone on calls before. Can you do this? Yeah, I've researched the heck out of this particular client or prospect, and I got to make sure that I mention these two points. Can I do this? Yeah, I think they're going to object to, they're going to have a problem with this one feature, but I got to make sure that I preempt that and talk about that rather than have them raise it. Can I do this? Yeah, you know, last time I talked too much and didn't listen enough, I'm going to have to try to do that differently. And so the interrogative self-talk, which again, your very, very insightful point that it shows a degree of vulnerability, actually ends up being more effective because it's a form of rehearsal. It's a form of practice. It's a form of preparation. And this interrogative self-talk, like some of the other things you were talking about, actually is more powerful, but it's a quieter kind of muscularity. And I think that, you know, if our politicians adopted that kind of approach that evinced a little bit more generosity, a little bit more vulnerability, and this quieter kind of muscularity, I think they'd actually be more effective leaders.
That's interesting. Now, the flip side of this are, you know, words that describe a lot of CEOs and, oh, people say like Lance Armstrong, ruthless, not using a quieter kind of muscularity. And, I mean, you might argue that, well, that was Lance Armstrong's mistake, is going on the offensive to such a degree that he destroyed everyone around him. But what do you think about that style of leadership, the ruthless? I mean, is that going away or is this still an element in here?
You know what? I think that ruthlessness is always going to be an element of the human condition. I think today it's harder to get away with ruthlessness because we live in such a transparent world. And so ruthlessness might work in the short term, but in the long term, I'm really, you know, forget about the morality of being ruthless or not. I think in a very pragmatic way, I think that ruthlessness does not really work as a long-term strategy because eventually you're going to get found out. Mm-hmm. And I think it's another really good point because it goes to the nature of how the landscape has shifted. You know, in the old days, buyers never had a way to talk back, but now they do. So, you know, if I'm on an airline and I'm treated poorly, I can go to Twitter and complain about it. And that gives me a broadcast platform, or anybody, a broadcast platform that didn't exist even 6 or 7 years ago. And so this world of greater of information parity, of greater transparency, greater openness, is pushing people a little bit more to the high road. And because I think over the long term, taking the low road is inviable. And Lance Armstrong, you know, was just a, sort of a just a really hideous example of that.
Daniel, I've always heard, and I've been involved in sales to some degree in the past, that, you know, selling is about relationships. And as you drill down to the core essence of what you were looking for and framing it in terms of selling, are you trying? It sounds like you're reframing authentic relationship, the nature of authentic relationship.
Yeah, I think that's a, good point there too. I actually put more on the. I think there's a heavier weight on the authentic part than on the relationship part. That authenticity is, you know, a sibling of openness, transparency, and vulnerability. I think relationships still matter, but what I heard over and over again from talking to salespeople was that relationships didn't matter in the sense that you're treating people well, you're serving them, you're being a good and honest person. But what mattered even more is expertise. That today, when buyers have almost as much information as, you know, can have as much information as sellers, the seller has to have some expertise in what he or she is selling. You can't just have a slight information advantage as you had in the past, where, say, a car dealer or a seller of anything, buyers had no way to get a lot of information. So the sellers who had a little bit of information had an advantage. So you used your advantage, you used your slight information advantage along with your gregariousness and party planning skills, and that made you effective at sales. Those days are over. I think what matters now is expertise. And I think that, you know, building relationships is effective over the long term. But what I heard from salespeople is that expertise is as important, if not more important, than relationships. I think authenticity, though, is threaded through all of it because, again, we're in a very transparent world.
Our guest is Daniel Pink. He's the author of the book, To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. Pink is also the New York Times business bestseller, author of the books Drive and A Whole New Mind. So obviously you've brought lots of credibility and validity along with your modes of selling. Isn't that right, Daniel?
Well, I like to think so, but I'll let the reader judge that.
Okay, very good. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me, you guys.
Again, that was Daniel Pink. His book is To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. And, you know, this might be a book normally taken on by Mountain Money because selling is sort of in the workplace. But selling, as he talked about, is very much a lifestyle thing. We sell everywhere we go, all day long, every day. When was your latest sales job? Oh, it was this morning.
This morning over at Java Cow. We were doing a little promotion for Mountain Trails.
That's right. And we were selling, but we weren't selling anything. We were giving away those great ceramic mugs.
And actually, I'm not sure you did do a little selling there. I don't think I did much selling at all. I was just present for the whole experience.
It's funny how sometimes even giving away something you have to convince people of because they don't actually believe that it's a giveaway. Someone came in and we said, here's this free great ceramic travel mug. You get free coffee in it. It goes for Mountain Trails. And he said, oh, no, thank you. So then that's when we had to do the sales job.
You did.
Yes, yes. But he was happy in the end. Okay, you're listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. We'll be right back.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided by Longreimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-LAW.com. Park City Nursery. For 30 years, we know what grows. ParkCityNursery.com. VaultHomeLoans.com. Purchase and refinance mortgages. Conventional FHA and VA. 801-201-3484. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. Want to thank our underwriters today.
Grand Valley Bank, Prudential Utah Real Estate, Park City Clinic, Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, San Francisco Design, and Stein Erickson Lodge and Spa.
And be sure to tune in to Cool Science Radio tomorrow, Thursday at 9 a.m. You've been listening to KPCW Park City. You can always catch archive shows on kpcw.org.